you, and longer if I can. How long will I need you? As long as the seasons need to follow their plan. How long will I be with you? As long as the sea is bound to wash upon the sand. How long will I want you? As long as you want me to, and longer by far.
Good morning, folks. Good Friday morning. If it is Friday and if it is 11 a.m. and you're hearing that song, you know it's of No Fixed Address with your host, Al. And since we last spoke, we've had a bit of a change in our environment. We got snow on the ground now. And, you know, that's never pleasant for the folks that are out there. I don't like snow at the best of times, so whether it's minus 30 or minus 3, it's not a good thing. Having spent a couple of years out there, it is currently at minus 3, and it's a damp minus 3, which makes it, you know, pretty hard to be out there. You know, you and I walk down the street, go in and out of buildings, and leave our homes and get into our cars, but there are folks that are out there 24/7. And be kind, as we always say. If you're going to Tim's, buy an extra coffee or tea. Give it to somebody who might need it more than you. And, well, today we have a really different show than we usually have. We're talking healthcare, and we're talking to a wonderful person that I met not that long ago, maybe 3 or 4 months, but we kind of developed a connection right away. And because I'm involved in the healthcare system in a few ways, we got connected. And today I have on a person I'd like to consider a friend, Dr. Tara Hurrell. Tara, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me today.
And I know that, you know, we haven't even talked about being on the show very much. And I think I just brought it up last week or this week sometime.
This week, Wednesday.
This week. And I was so happy that you said yes, because what you do for your work is really, really important to everyday folks, but people living beneath the poverty, people who are in a state of vulnerability, and people that are often not given the care that they need within the healthcare system. And as a person who lived through not being cared for as, or not being even considered important to look at or care for as a homeless person, this strikes to the soul of what I do, you know, in my work and in my everyday life, and trying to bring health equity to folks and other things like that. But today, I'm so happy that you're on. And I'd just like to, as I do with all of my guests, and we spoke earlier, just a brief or however long you care to take, or however much you care to share, bit of a biography, history of who you are and how you got to the stage in your life and what, why you're doing what you do today.
Yeah. So as you said, my name is Tara Horrell. I use the pronouns she, her, and I'm a white settler, born and grew up in Manitoba. And I have been a nurse now for, I guess, coming up to 19 years, which sounds a lot longer than it feels. But I started my nursing career actually in an emergency department. I spent a couple of years there, and that really did give me some, you know, firsthand experience seeing people who are coming into an emergency department who, you know, are often quite marginalized
from society. That's what I was looking for, marginalized, yes.
Yeah. And then I moved actually over to an oncology role. I worked as an oncology nurse for close to a decade. Mm. And that's where I started noticing that we were seeing some people being diagnosed with, you know, really advanced cancers that are actually often found very early through, you know, routine cancer screening services. And yet they weren't being diagnosed early. They were being diagnosed quite late. And I was, you know, just curious about why this was happening. And so that led me to graduate school, where I did a Master of Nursing and then a PhD. And I focused my PhD research on looking at barriers to accessing cancer care for Indigenous populations in Canada.
So such important work.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a huge learning curve for me. And a lot of what I was seeing in that work was not around anything to do with the people themselves not being able to access care or not wanting to. It was really around how the systems are designed to exclude certain people and certain populations from care, and how, you know, we really need to think about how our systems of care are designed to be more equitable. And then following that work, I started a postdoc fellowship at the University of British Columbia in conjunction with BC Cancer. And there we were really looking at how to better design cancer care services to be more equitable and more accessible for people who, again, you know, we would call structurally marginalized.
Marginalized, so, yes.
Yeah. And so that's not a characteristic of themselves. It's it's a result of...
Of the system.
Of the systems, of, you know, intersecting social structures.
Yes.
You know, going as broad as... public policy and economic policy, and so on. Yeah,
it's you mentioned the Indigenous persons, and you know, 75% of our folks on the street are Indigenous, right? And they are more marginalized even than a person like me, who really, really suffered on the street. But it's nothing compared to what our Indigenous brothers and sisters suffer. It's I appreciate the fact that this is something that you've worked on, because it's terrifying, the lives that are lost because people are marginalized by the system. And you know, and especially with something like cancer care, we started talking about earlier prior to coming into the studio, and again, the system works against marginalized people and people living in poverty and people who are Indigenous. Again, why is that? You know, it's, you know, you, why is that?
Where to start?
Where to start? It's such a tough thing to live through, you know. And when you're talking about something like cancer care, which is life-taking, you would think that there would be health equity in that, but there isn't.
There is not, no. So what we know about cancer and cancer care is that when people are marginalized, so they're, you know, experiencing sort of these overlapping and intersecting effects of things like poverty, unstable housing, discrimination, stigma, mental health challenges, and so on. People who have those experiences are less likely to get screened for cancer.
Yeah.
They're less likely to be diagnosed with preventable cancers. Mm-hmm. When they are diagnosed with cancer, it's typically diagnosed at much more advanced stages than it would be for someone like me who has a high degree of privilege. Mm-hmm. Going kind of across that cancer care spectrum,
right.
They are less likely to get treatment for their cancer. If they do get treatment, mm-hmm. it's often of poorer quality.
Yes.
And if they do survive their cancer, they often experience poor pain and symptom mm-hmm. management and are more likely to die of their cancer than people who have more privilege in society. So there's a lot of disparities and inequities across mm-hmm. that cancer continuum.
Oh, yeah. It's such a sad reflection on the system that we have.
It is. It makes me think of, in Canada, we kind of, this is my perception anyways, mm-hmm. as Canadians, we kind of pride ourselves on our healthcare system to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at, you know, the picture that I just laid out.
Yeah. It's nothing to be proud of.
It's nothing to be proud of. And in our healthcare system that sort of, says that it's universally accessible. It isn't. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of segments of the population that are not able to access healthcare in the same way, including cancer care.
Yeah, and you know, others. And the problem with not giving people equitable healthcare is that it's more costly to the system than
in the long run,
because you start talking terminal and things like. There's so much extra care that has to go into. Mm-hmm. To that process, again, an ounce of prevention is, you know,
a pound of cure,
and it's just so sad. And I think we've all known people that have had cancer and passed away from it. But it's, because I spent time on the streets, and because I've received, I received no help, a number of times, which. Presented life-taking experience for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I really find it hard to accept the way Indigenous peoples are being treated in our emergency rooms and in our systems like healthcare. And mm-hmm. you know, we hear people, again, it's related, but not, you know, people dying in our emergency rooms. Because they are Indigenous and not being looked after, and when we get into cancer care, it's such an important issue that we deal with it in the right and equitable way. Mm-hmm. And another project that you're working on too was, can you talk to me a little bit about the homeless and those, and it's really related. You talked a little bit about the palliative care project that you've been working on.
Yeah, so that's a project that's actually running out of BC. It's mm-hmm. it's so there's two BC based projects. Mm-hmm. One, which is finished, was a project that followed people who are living in extreme poverty and in some way were unstably housed, mm-hmm. so often living in shelters mm-hmm. or cars mm-hmm. or tents or so on, as well as their support people, as well as their healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. And these were people who were towards the end of life and receiving palliative care in some way. And most of them were... had a diagnosis of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so what we were interested in is sort of looking to earlier in their illness trajectory mm-hmm. to the point at which they were diagnosed with cancer and were trying to get cancer treatment. And so what we saw was that most of the participants in this study were diagnosed with cancers at quite late stages, mm-hmm. so advanced cancers that often had already spread. Mm-hmm. And that almost none of those, actually I think none of those participants were able to complete their course of cancer treatment because of their life circumstances, mm-hmm. Their housing situation, their economic situation, their social support situation, their experiences yes. with healthcare. So they were not able to complete cancer treatment. And then at the same time, despite these very obvious and huge you know, social needs that they had. Mm-hmm. Those needs were not identified within the cancer care that they received, and there was no plan to address their social care, mm-hmm. not a coordinated and systematic plan anyways. And so, you know, people, you know, we really saw that meeting those social needs early and upfront was the key to be able to, you know, get and complete their cancer treatment. If those needs were not addressed, people were not able to get their cancer treatment. It makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. If you're thinking about, you know, you're living in a shelter or on the street, like how could you possibly attend to a cancer diagnosis and go through treatment, which we know are really quite grueling?
How do you do that?
Yeah, when you literally don't have a roof over your head. So it makes sense that, you know, you're prioritizing survival needs, shelter, food, income, first before you do anything else.
First.
And so I think, you know, we really saw this huge gap where the cancer care sector was not able to see that that was a priority and that they had a role to play in order for these folks to be able to actually get treatment.
You and I talked earlier about this three-strike rule, and I cannot believe in cancer that there's a three-strike rule, or in healthcare, never mind cancer care, but in healthcare, there's a three-strike rule, because what's more important than a person's health and mortality, right?
Yeah.
Talk just a little bit about that.
Yeah, this was something that... this was a different study, the one that's ongoing right now, but similar, where we're looking at how to try to make cancer services designed more equitably. Mm-hmm. And in talking to participants in this study, they kept referring to this three strikes rule. And at first I thought, well, this can't actually be a written policy. And it is.
That's unbelievable, actually.
It is unbelievable. And I don't know if it's across the board or if it's just in certain departments.
Sure.
But essentially, it's this, you know, rule where if you miss three appointments, then you're sent, you know, there's a referral letter sent back to your referring physician or nurse practitioner saying, you missed three appointments, sorry. If you want to come back, then you'll need another referral. And so I think it's a real problem for people who are highly marginalized, because even just simply showing up for an appointment, there's so many more barriers for someone like living in those circumstances than there would be for me. And you know, there's the obvious ones like transportation, having someone come with you, but there's less obvious ones too, at least less obvious to a lot of people, in that if you have been discriminated and experienced stigma every single time that you've shown up to a healthcare institution, why would you want to come back?
Yes. That is so real.
Yeah.
And as a person that experienced that, wow, it's a true barrier. And because I do a lot of advocacy work on poverty, and I'm going to send you my Poverty Dimensions piece that I wrote, and it kind of describes what people living beneath the poverty line have to go through, and marginalized folks. And, you know, a person would have a difficult time even getting to an appointment with the doctor if, because of the standards that Welfare EIA writes on getting even bus passes.
Yeah.
If you do not have four appointments a week, you do not get a bus pass.
Yeah, so, and there were some interesting things that have come out of this study, too, that I wouldn't have necessarily thought of. So for someone who's maybe living in a shelter or a single-room occupancy hotel, often what, if they're well-connected to a primary care clinic or a setting, then what happens is the primary care clinic will arrange for an outreach worker or some sort of support person to pick them up, go with them to their cancer appointment, sort of be that liaison, that support person, but also help make decisions and so on, and coordinate some aspects of care, and then bring them back. But if someone is scheduled, you know, for an 8 a.m. appointment and their outreach worker doesn't start till 8:30, well, guess what? They're not going to be able to come to that appointment. And so there's that sort of lack of awareness and recognition on the part of the cancer care sector that is problematic.
But there are also so many people that don't have that.
They don't have that service.
That service, that intensive case manager, or that person to walk them through this.
Exactly. And we are seeing that in our past and ongoing research as well, that mm-hmm. social support is a huge, huge yes. piece of what allows people to access or not
and
healthcare broadly.
Absolutely. And, you know, in my first job after 2.5 years of homelessness and 2.5 years in quote-unquote recovery was as an intensive case manager in the At-Home Safe Swap program. And my job was to look after the needs of folks mm-hmm. that we just house or keep them in housing and help them with things like we're just talking about. But a lot of those folks would have never gotten to the appointments because mm-hmm. lots of times there's an aversion to seeing that particular doctor.
Definitely.
We had to do our job in supporting them and maybe even convincing them that, yes, you have to go to this.
Yeah.
But so many people, especially folks on the street or in shelters, don't have that. Mm-hmm. And they're virtually living on their own. I spent 14 months in Salvation Army, and they do really, really good work. And every, during the second phase mm-hmm. of my homeless life, they do really, really good work. But they also don't provide that help or that for folks that need to get out there and see their EIA or welfare worker or see the doctor. And it's you know, the system needs to be changed in a huge, huge way, right?
Yeah, there's definitely, I think what you're touching on is that, you know, support, but also that coordination piece where, mm-hmm. you know, thinking about
entirely
cancer care, mm-hmm. it is actually an incredibly complex system mm-hmm. and process where, you know, you're accessing care at many different points through a primary care provider, through, you know, if you do get a diagnosis of cancer, mm-hmm. you might be seeing, you know, three different oncologists, mm-hmm. you might be getting multiple types mm-hmm. of treatment, you're interacting with many different allied health providers, yes. nurses, social workers,
yes.
radiation therapists, mm-hmm. coming and going at all, you know, times of the day and week to different clinics and
yes.
outpatient settings.
Yes.
It's very overwhelming, mm-hmm. even for me, who understands yes. the system and has a lot of healthcare knowledge. I would find it overwhelming. And so for someone
yeah.
who doesn't have that, who doesn't have the resources, and maybe doesn't have that health literacy, it's really a lot.
And that's the thing, too, as well, is, you know, folks on the street are so traumatized as well. They don't have the
yeah.
communication skills.
Yep.
One of the best things we can do for folks on the street is work with them on communication skills as well, because they fight their EIA workers, they fight the healthcare system because they don't have those skills to mm-hmm. actually communicate what's wrong or, you know, or communicate things that
yeah.
need to be communicated. Debbie, you seem to express some interest. Do you have anything to say on this? No? but it's, there's so much that is needed, and having lived through the welfare system as well, and not being able to access.
Yeah. I think the trauma piece is huge.
Trauma is huge.
Talked about that
Let's
yet.
Talk about, yeah,
but
after we break, we'll talk about trauma.
Sure.
Because it's one of the things that is, a huge barrier. And so many people don't understand.
Yeah.
The trauma I suffered, the thing that separates people living in poverty and homelessness is trauma from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big separation piece. That's the big identity. And it took me almost 7 years to get over the trauma of homelessness. And during that time, I lost all, you know, I on the street, I lost my confidence, I lost my self-worth and all that kind of stuff. And trauma was the key ingredient to me losing all of that stuff and getting back to being a human being. And yeah, let's talk about trauma because it's so important to basic, self-confidence and self-care as well, and even the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure.
But we'll come back in a few minutes. So we'll just take a quick music break and we'll be back in a few minutes. But stay tuned, folks, for more of this interesting conversation. And we're back, folks. That particular CD was Will Bonas and Subtle Fire. Debbie knows I like slow jazz, and so she always finds something to put on that.
Perfect for a Friday morning.
Yeah, perfect for a Friday morning. And folks, you're listening to CKW 95.9 FM, your community radio station right here at the University of Winnipeg, a place that I've come to really love and spend time, in studio. And, we spent 2 years, Debbie, we spent 2 years away from studio during COVID. And that was not nearly as much fun, talking on your phone to folks that are on another phone. But being in studio, it was such a... so much more ambiance and atmosphere. And today I have a really special guest, Dr. Tara Harrell, and we've been talking about cancer care and marginalized folks who don't necessarily get the care that they deserve and need, and that everybody should have equitable care. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that just a little bit later. But one of the things that we were discussing earlier as well is trauma. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're talking cancer, because am I going to live or am I going to die? Is this treatment going to work? I mean, there's got to be so much trauma in that.
There's the trauma of a cancer diagnosis, mm-hmm. and the treatment. Mm-hmm. There's the trauma that you were mentioning before we mm-hmm. took a break, which is of experiences of, extreme poverty mm-hmm. and homelessness. Mm-hmm. So those are layered onto each other. There's, when we're talking about people who are structurally marginalized, and earlier we were talking about Indigenous populations, mm-hmm. there's, potentially historical trauma related to...
Entirely.
residential school survivors,
right.
60 Scoop and so on,
yes.
intergenerational
yes.
trauma, even just, I've heard in a couple of my research studies for some Indigenous people, some hospitals resemble a residential school. So just showing up physically at the building is
traumatic.
That can
be traumatizing.
Right. Yeah, and then there's also the trauma of when you are, marginalized from the system and you try to access care and you receive awful care mm-hmm. that's discriminatory and racist and stigmatizing, that's also traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And so accessing any type of healthcare can be re-traumatizing
yeah.
for people. But then there's some specific aspects of cancer care also that, where procedures tend to be quite invasive.
Yes.
And so if people have personal histories of physical or sexual mm-hmm. trauma, that adds a whole new layer. So there's
yeah.
lots of different aspects of trauma that we need to consider and aren't often considered in healthcare broadly, but also in cancer care specifically.
We grew up thinking that the healthcare system is something we can depend on.
Mm.
And I'll just get a little bit personal on this. When I mm-hmm. was rejected 3 times by a system that I thought would help me, that
mm-hmm.
was the only system I knew where I could go to
mm-hmm.
that would help me, and they didn't. I can, 17 hours later, I jumped off a bridge because I could not handle the trauma of not getting help,
yeah.
right? And when I desperately needed it. And I, that is so real.
Yeah.
And it is so punitive.
It is.
And I can't think of how great the trauma would be for a person going through cancer care.
Yeah.
Right? And dealing with that.
Yeah, I mean, it is something that we definitely need to be much more mm-hmm. aware of I think purposefully take a more trauma-informed approach
yes.
to how we deliver care,
mm-hmm.
but also looking at some of our policies and processes
yes.
through a trauma-informed lens as well.
I see people that had come through. I will just say this. It took me 6.5 years to get over my trauma
mm.
of the streets, right? And... of the near-death experiences and all that. It took me 6.5 years to get a voice even.
Yeah.
And I know so many people going through, even my tiny little surgery that I had a month, 5 weeks ago, there was a lot of trauma in that.
Mm.
More physical trauma than mental
yeah.
trauma. But there's trauma. And with cancer care, there's both physical and because it's intrusive.
Yes.
And also, you know, the mental health aspect and the mental trauma that people go through. I'm sure that that never goes away for a cancer person, a care person.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm not sure, to be honest, what that looks like. I think probably with really good supports. And, you know, psychological and mental health support, that perhaps some of that could be worked through. But I'm not sure that that always happens. And if it does happen, I'm not sure if it happens well.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, is like so many people mistrust the system. And it took me a while to get that back.
Yes, right? Definitely.
And the only thing that got back for me was a doctor at St. Barnabas Hospital. I'm not sure I ever told you that story, that she life-changing, life-sustaining words. But so many people, especially Indigenous folks, have bad experiences in the hospitals, in the healthcare system, that again, they have fear of coming back, right?
Yeah, we're seeing this a lot in our ongoing research, is that there is a lot of distrust in the system, in healthcare providers, in the information that we as healthcare providers are giving to patients. It's definitely, and it's valid distrust. There's a reason for it.
It is for sure. And, you know, again, we started talking about health equity and health inequity. And again, one of the great moments of my life is when I got to stand up in front of the entire hierarchy at the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority and all the department and talk about health inequity. Because they wanted their accreditation from Accreditation Canada, right? And I was a key part of that. And I really felt like I was being a hypocrite even speaking to them about it, because I'm not going to give you this. Are you kidding? You know, but again, we're just going to kind of talk about health equity or health inequity for a little while. And it's so pervasive, and it's there every single day. You know, again, we talk about marginalized folks. And you know, things like the three strikes you were just talking about. But but we need to build a better understanding within the healthcare system. And that's one of the things that I keep working on when I can nudge my way in. But, you know, have people understand the barriers of poverty. And sure, they don't see as many homeless folks, because those people just don't get there, and that's a huge part of health inequity. But even people living in poverty, which is more traumatizing than homelessness, at many, many times, and the barriers are so great. I think we need to bring a better level of understanding about folks in marginalized,
who are marginalized. I agree. I think we can, you know, we can and need to do that in a few different ways. We need to integrate some of those, you know, lived experiences into training for healthcare professionals when they're, you know, in their degree programs and whatnot. But also to have, you know, ongoing education. I think equally important, and we talked about this earlier, is that it's not just people who are providing direct care to patients that need this understanding. It's people in management and leadership positions as well, because they set the tone for organizations. They are the ones influencing policy, and direct care providers, you know, while they can do a lot to advance health equity, can only do so much, and they need to be supported.
And one of the conversations I got into that day at Deer Lodge Center, when we spoke to all those folks, was the fact that yes, we're becoming more task oriented than people oriented.
And we absolutely are.
And that can only change from the top down.
Yeah.
Right? And so when we're bringing people awareness of the marginalized folks and the care that we need to give them, we need to reach the folks at the top as well, right? And, you know, just to, you know, okay, this is the life. How are you going to improve it for them, for these folks who have problems accessing care? How are you going to improve it for the folks on the street? How are you going to improve? You know, the trauma of poverty is many times greater than homelessness at times. And for me, it was like that in the early years, because on the streets, I had nothing, no responsibilities. All I had to do was look after myself, right? And I had no responsibility paying rent, buying groceries, and today more than ever, we have a problem in our society right now with the inflationary world mm-hmm. we live in. And today, more than ever, the trauma of living in poverty is greater and greater and greater than homelessness. And in the first 3 years, I was a caregiver as well. I was learning about schizophrenia. I was learning how to deal with that kind of thing. But I had the responsibility of looking after this person and two cats, right? And making sure everybody had enough food to eat. And meanwhile, we were paying 80% of our income to rent. Mm. And so, again, I think we have to make the upper echelon of the healthcare system aware as well, just to guide principles, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, because the people on the front lines and the nurses can only do so much.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that's helpful is just to stop thinking about poverty or mm-hmm. even housing as an individual problem. It's not it's not created by individuals mm-hmm. and their faults mm-hmm. or their...
No.
Their lack ofs,
right.
But it's a structural problem. Mm-hmm. It's created by the policies and the context of our country, mm-hmm. of our province, and so on. And so it's really need to start, sort of taking a wide angle view of big issues like poverty mm-hmm. and stop trying to address them on an individual level.
Entirely. We're getting down to when we're going to end the show today. Is there anything that you would like to leave with the audience? And I think this has been a really informative. Debbie will tell you, this has been a really different show than what we usually do, but it's all related. And we need to be more person centered. Have that. And we can't do that without having an understanding of who that person is.
Yeah, I think person-centered care is definitely important, and I hope that we're heading in that direction. I think person-centered care can fit well with a health equity perspective, because mm-hmm. when we're thinking about health equity, we're thinking about how different people have different needs. Mm-hmm. They're advantaged or disadvantaged in different ways. And so if I think about me who, has a good income, a good education, mm-hmm. a house, a car, I may not need nearly as much support to get, my health needs met or make it through my cancer treatment
right.
than someone who's living in a shelter or unstably housed mm-hmm. and living in poverty. And so when we think about person-centered, mm-hmm. we can think about it through a lens of health equity, in that some people are going to have much greater needs mm-hmm. and than others.
Yes.
And we're not all starting on an equal playing field. And so
we're not.
To give some folks more support so they can have the same outcomes as other folks,
yes.
that would be a health equity approach.
Yeah, it would. And, even folks like the three of us in this room right now have difficulties at times with the healthcare system.
Yes.
And so if we have those difficulties,
yes.
what about a person who can't communicate, who comes across as, as somebody that they think is, way beneath them?
Yeah.
I had a doctor when I was in my third trip to the Health Sciences Center before I did my bridge jump and say, you have way too much to live for. You don't need us. I was on the final, the very, very thin string of hope, and it was broken by him, mm-hmm. or it was cut by him. And he told me, well, you don't need us. You have way too much to live for. I was dying. And he said, and so I questioned that, you have way too much to live for, you don't need us. And it's, okay, why do you say that?
Mm.
Because I'm a white person and everybody else in your waiting room is indigenous. That's the first thing that came to my mind. You're like, okay, what makes you say that when I just told you I'm at the end of my rope, right? And there is so much of that, those biases and stigmas that are carried around. And if I have a tough time as a white person, right, the problems of the indigenous population are even way worse. And 75% of our homeless population are indigenous. and people living in poverty, we have huge numbers as well. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, you and I are lucky to be in the position we are, but what about the people that aren't?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think we need to...
That's
why we do the work that we do. And I thank you for coming on and you know, just bring this to light and your work with cancer care. And I really appreciate your perspective, because not many folks that really understand it like you do. Mm. As a personal lived experience, I have that experience. But for you to see that is really exceptional, and I do thank you for that, because it means a lot, because I know how tough it is. But thank you for that, and thank you for coming on here today and giving our listeners something, a different show today, and
yeah,
something really, really valuable that I think people need to hear.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. It has been as well. And folks, come back next week. Actually, you know, I'm going to be in Halifax next week at a homeless conference, of course. And I think what we're going to do, I'm going to try to have a live program, because there's going to be like 1,400 people dealing with homelessness there. So I know I can find somebody to speak to on air about the situation, as it is a homeless conference. And I'll know probably half of the people there. But I think we're going to try to do a live broadcast and just figure out the time, because there's 2.5 hours difference, I think. And I'll be hitting up Deb's expertise on this one. And but come back next week, and we'll have another 45 minutes of worthwhile listening. Again, if you're going to Tim's, buy an extra coffee, buy an extra tea. It's one of those days where it's dampish out there, and these days are actually harder to live through than it is at minus 20, because it's a wet damp, and I found these days on the street way harder to get through, because it gets into your bones and you start shaking. And I remember shivering so many times. I felt like my teeth were going to fall out and my bones were going to break. And so, but be kind, folks. You know, folks need more than you, and maybe buy a box of Timbits too and hand those up. Anyway, till next week, take care. And it is -3, and it's going to stay roughly this temperature, going to -6 maybe. But be kind. Thank you. See you next week.
Templeton Revival every second Saturday from 11 till 1 on 95.9 CKUW. Your musical brunch in the wide open tent where we're serving up platters both hot and chill from near and far, from now and from way back when. Tune in to the TTR and revive a while with me, Old Kits. The menu's big and tasty, including jazz, global, and show tunes, composers, folk and blues, indie and new wave, electronics, and sonic tonics. Excellent, exceptional tunage, eclectically reflecting on local and world events. Drop in to enjoy some soon. Temple Tent Revival, every second Saturday, 11 till 1. Right here on 95.9. More on Facebook at Kits Temple.